session number 10168, reel number 12.
Mr. Donald Price, reel 12. You were telling me about when you were at ITARP Space Camp for a while. I wondered whether the severity of the training and the attitude of the instructors, did you think it was necessary to get the results, whether they could have got the results in a more humane manner?
Well, it didn't appear to me at the time that it was all that necessary. I suppose, actually, the orders to these sergeants and people who used to drill us was that they had to be firm to get us fit again in the shortest possible time to send us up the line again. I don't think they could have done it by kindness. I doubt it. Because you've got to imagine that nearly every soldier I knew was on the scrounge. If he could dodge anything, he would do. That was my... I was one of them. And I scrounged if I possibly could. And I don't know a soldier yet who said, that the discipline did him any harm. I don't think so. I don't think really those men would have been got fit enough to go up the line had it not been for a very, very strict discipline, which was, of course, enforced by the sergeants and people who were in charge of us all, because we're a very, very mixed lot, you know. I mean, you'd got all kinds of people there. All regiments, all classes of people. You'd got people coming back from leave, you'd got people who coming back from hospital. All regiments, every regiment, good, bad and different, we were all there. I can't remember any foreigners being there, any Africans or Australians, but I feel that there was some element of Australians and South Africans in it. I can't say for certain, but I have an idea that they were included in that group. There were really thousands of people at ETAPS, you know, under camp. Thousands of us. And as I say, I doubt whether any easing off of discipline would have been any good for the lot that were there at the time.
But nevertheless, you did.
Oh, we hated it for the simple reason that it was so strict. And whether it had to be so strict or not, I wouldn't know. The point was being out of the line, probably coming back from hospital, coming back from a soft leave and coming back from somewhere else, which had been an easy life, and all of a sudden you're thrust into terrible discipline. Most people would go against it in any case, but when you were away from the line, it was hard to take it. You at least thought you were entitled to some sort of easing off of discipline. It was hard enough up the line. When you came out for rest, at least, as I say, you didn't expect that real tightness of this discipline, which was really, I mean, it was really strict. I mean, the bullying that went on from the sergeants and those people under the ordinary rank, it was really something to think very seriously about, I thought. But we took it because you couldn't do anything else. I mean, not that I knew, but you wanted to stay there as long as you could. And if by any chance probably you became unruly or didn't like the discipline, it was an easy matter for the sergeant to say, look, you're going up the line tomorrow, or you're going to join your regiment tomorrow. And I think consequently that might have been why we all took it. You took it up to a point. And then, of course, a certain amount of a certain group of people, apparently, I wasn't understanding, they refused to take it, and they just said, we're not having it, and they did a bit of rioting.
But there was no sign of that while you were there?
No, there wasn't a sign of it when I was there, and I think I was there about a fortnight after.
Were you allowed into the village at Tarps at all?
You could get a pass out. You know, there was a bridge there going into a place called Latuque and places like that, the other side of the river. But the only way you could get there was over a bridge. And if you remember on the scenes, the riot actually was on the bridge, people trying to get out of the place.
What was it like in Latuque?
Oh, it was quite nice. Actually, at the end of... from this period, my next wound, when I, at the end of the war, when I got the last wound, which was in October, I came down to Boulogne Hospital again. And that
we'll come to that then. I think best keep it in order. Wait, did you go into the village?
Yes, I went in. You see, you could go in, you were spared, you were allowed, if you're lucky, you're allowed a pass to go out over the bridge into the town.
What did you do?
What was it? Latuque, and there was another place. Very fashionable places now, but in those days, they were just villages. You did nothing else but beer and women if you could find them. That was about the only thing a soldier sort of lived for in those days. There were no concerts over there. The concerts appeared in the camp itself. It really was a vast camp, and I remember there was a great big hall there in the camp. And that was the first time that I ever saw the film of the Somme. They got the film, and that was when it first came out. It was shown to us in this great big hut.
Had you seen them preparing the film at all?
No.
What did you think of it then, the film? Did you think it was...
Well, you know, it was to see people moving about, soldiers up, you know, and... hoping to see your regiment or something like that. Of course, you didn't recognise anybody because these fellows were marching with tin hats on and rifles and singing songs, which we knew was bloody nonsense, you know. And it didn't... It was nice to see it, to think that I'd been there amongst all that lot. But the initial film of the Somme was very amateurish. You see, the people who were taking it, the film cameras, they were allowed to go, but they'd be damn fools if they'd gone up into all those barrages, which this song was, you know, was sort of contained of. And you might get somebody up there sneaking a photograph, but generally speaking, no report. I never saw a reporter anywhere near the front line, anyhow, with a camera. But they were there because that was the proof of it.
You said
that more often than not, it was nothing to do with attacks. It was people behind the line, and you could see shells bursting in the distance and things like that. That was the film with the original song.
This original film, you said some of it was nonsense. What do you mean in particular was
nonsense?
Well,
people cheering to go in the line and you know, troops marching and the singing songs and all like that. Nobody going anywhere near that lot sang songs, believe me.
But you enjoyed the film nevertheless.
I enjoyed the film, I think, because I happened to be part of it. I never saw anything of high wood or anything, but the point was it was a Somme. It was the battle. And I'd taken part in that battle. And really it was, you know, something I was supposed to be proud of, really. I suppose that was the thought that I had in my younger days. Big stuff, you know.
Now, while you were at Etampes, did you come across the Red Caps, the military police?
Oh, they were there. They were all over the place. They were part of the discipline. I mean, you'd still got to walk about dressed properly. And you'd still got to behave yourselves. I mean, there was no sort of rowdy drunkenness, anything like that. There'll always beer on the premises. There was nothing unruly about anybody, because the Red Caps were there, and if you were doing anything wrong at all against the discipline of staying out late or being outside the tent at certain hours or trying to sneak out anywhere, you'd be for what we call the high jump in the morning.
Did you have any trouble yourself with
that? No. Actually, funny enough, when I was there, I got my ankle, which bad, and I couldn't get on parade to do any of this marching about business. My ankle was still reasonably bloody, and they made me I was a batman to an officer, I forget his name now, and I'd got to clean his boots and clean his belt and things like that in his tent. He had a tent on his own. I didn't make his bed, he had a bed, and sort of generally look after him. I forget his name now.
How did you feel about that? You hadn't been
well, it was part of my job. I mean, you know, I mean, I was given this job. It was easy because I wasn't on parade. You'd do anything to get out of the bloody parade, you see. And I didn't mind cleaning a fellow's boots or what have you. And I think, nice chap. You know, I think he gave me a franc or two to, you know, a pot. And
would you have wanted to do it in the line?
Oh, no, in the line.
Or anywhere else, you know, would you have regularly wanted to be an officer?
Oh, no. I just accepted it down there because, you see, I'd got this ankle. I was immobile, really. And all I got to do is to walk from one tent to another. It was very handy, his tent to mine, actually. And he was on his own, the officers. They had a group of tents there for officers. And I had to look after him, as I said, clean his belt and all his shoes, keep makes him, you know, tidy and... And I don't know what I'd... Oh, he went out for his grub. Oh, that's right. He went out for his food. So I didn't do anything about food. It was only a case of keeping him and his hut tidy, really.
What was the military police's reputation amongst the men? Were they as unpopular as the Yellow Caps, or were they less so?
Oh, they were they're just the same. They're all on the same. They're all on the same level. They were all there on that level to keep discipline. The sergeants and old people like that had the discipline on the parade grounds, but the Red Caps had the discipline in the camp itself, keeping you in order in the camp. As soon as you got on the parade ground, you got the sergeants in the drilling and things like that, you see. Mm. That was the difference between the two. Mm.
So, in November, sort of mid-November, you went back to your unit. Back to the 20th Battalion. They were in the Ypres area, I believe. Exactly they were?
Well, I think I joined them, I think, at a place called... I think I joined the billet itself at a place called Zillingbeck. I think we were in reserve there at a place called Zillingbeck, around the lake, and I was in the dugout, really in the banks of the lake itself. And from there, we did fatigues going up and down.
What kind of dugout would that be?
Just dug in the side. The water was fairly low in the lake, and we sort of... It wasn't a dugout. You dug into the side of the bank. We called them dugouts. Cubby holes, anything you like. You just got in for shelter, and away you slept. It was easy, really. See, you had to dig down for a start. You bored into the side of the bank, which is easy. that's why. There were quite a few of us in dugouts. We called everything dugouts. We were there, and from there we did our fatigues before we went up into action.
What were the working parties, fatigue parties? What did you do on these?
Well, it was so. The ground itself was so appalling.
And it got worse from when you were there.
Oh,
in
God, yes. You see the intense shelling. All the time, shelling was on and on. It was endless. And as I think I said before, that the Battle of 17, there was no land there at all. There was no earth. It had all been moved and jumbled about, and mounds there which weren't there before. And shell holes. The whole place was pockmarked with shell holes, and it was a case of water and earth and no trees, no vegetation, no nothing. And you see that the all those fellows who were up there in the front line, they'd got to be fed, they'd got to be hired, they'd got to be kept alive. And one of the first things we had to do, I remember, we had to carry these bloody duck boards up to put on top of the earth, to make a path up to the line. And you'd be amazed. We must have taken up thousands of these things, not me, but over the course of the battle, to get anywhere. More often than not, you've got to get on a duckboard. And it was really, it was quite true that in some cases, if you fell off and you weren't helped on back on, you're a goner.
Did you ever see that happen, or was it?
No, I've seen fellas fell off because I fell off, but I only fell off up to my knees, and sort of scrambled back. But it was so usual.
When you fell off up to your knees, would you have gone down further if you hadn't?
No, I don't think so. I think I bottomed where I was, you see, in this certain part. I mean, it wasn't all, as you say, it wasn't all that deep. But generally speaking, there's certain parts of the place, certain parts of the ground itself were so soggy and so muddy, and it had been churned up so much with shells, it was just like it was liquid mud, really. It wasn't.
What state did your uniform get into?
Imagine it. Imagine your rifle. You're supposed to shoot out of your rifle. You drop your rifle, I mean, in the mud. You've got to pick it up. You can't wash your rifle. And the whole... you yourself became mud-caked with mud. And as it was, we had to go in the lines with our overcoats on, for the it was so desperately cold. Imagine one of these coats getting wet, never mind being covered with mud, and your equipment and your overcoat, your tin hat and rifle and ammunition. You were loaded. You got big boots on. You got putty. You got extra jumpers on. You got gas masks. Entrenching tools, the whole thing, how we moved at all was a problem. And as far as saying what I call advancing or running anyway, you couldn't run, you walk, never mind, run.
So you were doing these fatigues, and then when you went up into the line, whereabouts did you go?
Well, as far as I know, as far as I remember, you see, it's all... there was no landmarks anywhere. You've got to realise that, and it's only lately that I knew that I was at a certain spot at a certain time. Now
that's from the battalion histories.
That's in histories. You see, we're going up the line. Right, what that means really, if you're going up the line, you're going into the front, you know, trenches. That's the usual remark. That we're going up the line. And that's generally that you're going into the attack or you're going into support or something. And consequently, all right, your officers knew they were going, but they didn't. They only knew where they were going by footpath. And by certain stakes, sort of stuff, that had been put in the ground. Woods that used to be, there were no woods. There were only stumps of trees there. And on one of the stumps of trees, somebody might have stuck a notice. That way to so-and-so, that way to Polygon Wood, that way to somewhere else. And those are the only indications you got where the hell you were, you see. If there had been a village there, you didn't know, because that village has probably been turned up and churned up, and bricks and mortar all that were underneath the mud. You never saw a village. Very seldom you saw any bricks or mortar at all. Any village that wasn't there.
Would you be in the area of the Menin Road as it went forward, though, on either side, if you
were
Zillibeck, Zonnibeck?
Yes, well, the Menin Road went up, and what was the other place? Well, the Menin Road was the chief road into the battle, I'll say that, you see, but you branched off. And don't forget this, when you're talking about Ypres, you see, Ypres was only about 4 miles from the front line. And anything that ridge, the Passchendaele Ridge, wasn't more than 4 miles from Ypres itself. It doesn't seem very long, saying 4 miles, but to walk a mile, it would probably take you a day to get anywhere, in those conditions.
So what was it like in the front line? Was the front line one of these shell holes?
Oh, your continuous shell holes. Sometimes a shell hole, and then you'd miss, and then another shell hole. Somebody might join up, and, you know, it'd make a sort of trench like that. But in the ordinary way, there was no trenches as such. There was no continuous trenches, because, I mean, you made a trench, it was blown up the next minute. You see, with the shelling, there's no sort of continuous trench, as far as I remember. although eventually, I think when things settled down a bit, they did start trenching a bit, because I've seen the remains of trenches there now, in the wood. But as far as I remember, there was no trench. When I went up on, when I went up the last time on these duckboards, when they were attacking the next morning, we were going in the line to attack the next morning when I was doing that message, I remember on that duckboard, there was no such, when I got to the front line, the sergeant major, he was certainly in a trench, but it was a trench that had been made out of a continuous shell hole. Get the idea?
Yeah. Was there a lot of water in the bottom of these?
Oh God, yes. So it was. You'd got to watch where you were. I mean, I think I said that I was lying in a shell hole for 2 days, with water up to your knees. Mind, we'd got gun boots on, you know, those great big gun boots. We'd got up to here. And they were heavy enough, God knows. Mm. And you were... To dodge water, it was a job, you know, to skirt a shallow which wasn't full of water. It really was a job. And when you came farther back where the where horses and things like that had been, I mean, you dead horses and blood and all of shallows coloured in blood, horses and mules all smelling dead all over the place, apart from humans. That was the condition of Ypres in those days.
What was your morale like, so to speak? How did you feel in there? Were you able to keep going cheerfully?
You've got to keep going. I mean, your discipline was so intense in those days. I don't remember anybody what they call thunking it. You know, he might have been like me. I was scared stiff. Well, I got the wind up naturally. Who hadn't? You're under this intense shelling all the time, and you see your pals getting killed. It sort of took it all. Whether I became numb to it or used to death and used to blood and snot, and I just don't know. But it never affected me at all. I can't think of any condition in my mind that happened after me living amongst all that stuff. I don't think, apart from fear, which I call wind up, apart from that, I don't think that, as I say, sympathy wasn't there. The first thing I ever thought, get out of this lot as quick as I can. As soon as you're up there, you look forward to the day when you're going to be relieved to get out of it.
Was religion any help to you? Or?
I don't think so. Although I was a very religious boy, you see, I'd been in the choir and all that kind of thing. And I knew then, and I think now, that I said my prayers every night, even in the worst conditions. I think, I'm bloody certain I said my prayers every night. But I'm not going to say I was on my knees, anything like that, but I'm certain that my
religion... Did it give you any comfort, or was it just a habit?
It was a habit. I personally thought that, well, now, it wasn't a case of... it was a case of, I dare not do it. You see what I mean? I dare not pray. See? And yet, is praying going to do me any good?
And so you didn't have that... Some people had a feeling of security that it wouldn't happen to them because
no, God no, I no, I didn't think, ever thought that by praying that that the bullets and everything else would miss me. I never thought that for one moment. I think the only thing is that by the grace of God, it, at some time it might help me. But even then, I didn't really. I think the thought, as I said, was that I'd got to say my prayers in case. See, that was the sort of feeling I'd got about praying then. But I know I did pray every night.
Did you have an attitude to shell shock? Did you think it was real? Or you see any examples
of
it?
Oh, I saw people shell shocked, and it wasn't very nice.
What were the symptoms as
well? Well, you just got a fellow there, some that had gone morose, and, you know, they wouldn't talk to you for a long time, and then all of a sudden other fellows would go sort of semi-raving, you know, go off the deep end, temper and Christ knows what, and crying. That was the kind of thing that happened. Unfortunately, I never saw very much of it. I saw one or two what's this, morose is the word, they'd gone into themselves. They weren't interested in anything else but getting out of it.
Did you think that shell shock was a medical condition, or did you think it was a failure of the will? Or
oh, well, he just thought it was a failure of life itself, actually. A failure of the mind to take the enormous pressure that it had got, not for a minute, but for probably 2 or 3 days on the run. If you're standing under a bombardment for so long and you're seeing fellas going up in the air and you've got a ticket for a couple of 3 days, it isn't funny. And something in some people has got to go, and it went in some people.
So it wasn't that they were cowards, it was just that they...
No, I don't think they were cowards at all. Any man that went up there, if he was a coward, he wouldn't have gone. He'd have done anything not to go up there. But once he got up there, you're not going to tell me a fellow was a coward because he couldn't stand this. I mean, people just don't understand what a barrage is, you know. The din, the row, the swishing of the shells, you can hear them coming. You hear the shells coming towards you. You hope very well it's going to burst here or there. And not one shell, but hundreds of shells over the area. And all of a sudden you might find yourself alone. Everything else has gone west.
Were there any cases of suicide or self-inflicted wounds?
I never saw it, actually. I never saw it, but I think I know a fellow who shot himself through his foot. But I wondered about it many, many a time. You know, I sort of got the thought vaguely, but it never happened, thank the Lord.
You mean you thought of doing it
yes,
yourself?
Yes, but it never happened. I mean...
You never got...
I felt that too much of a coward or something to, you know, do things like that. Or I felt that the consequences were that if you found out, you know... You're for it.
What about accidentally on purpose wounds, holding your hand above the parapet, that sort of thing? Well, above the...
Yeah, no, I never... I knew it happened, but I personally can't say that I saw it because I never did.
So it wasn't that common as far as you were...
Oh, no, it wasn't common a bit. There was no self-wounding as far as I remember. Not in my period, and I was in the war a long time, but I never saw anybody...
Now, you went back in November 17, and you were in and out of the line in the Ypres area until round about January. Are there any other incidents you remember from that time?
Well, we go into the line, you see, and we'd come out again, but we wouldn't necessarily come out to, say, Zillebeke again. We'd come somewhere else. Well, actually, I was in... I found myself in a billet in the square, immediately opposite the cloth hall, which was flat then, and all the shops were flat. But we found, Pal and I found, you had to scrounge yourself, we found a cellar immediately opposite the cloth hall. And I've seen the shop, of course it's all built up now, but I can pinpoint the exact spot where I was in a shell hole, in a cellar.
How many of you would be in the cellar?
Well, I think there were only two of us. You found your own, you know. Somebody might be next door, might be five or six at next door, but this was actually his two of us in this little... we found this, you see.
What did you have down there? What was the first?
Oh, nothing, just nothing. You just went in there for shelter, actually, and then you had to come out and get your own grub and find you, you know...
That would be the reserve position, would it?
Oh, you're out on reserve then, yes.
And then when you were in rest, you'd
and
go back to...
And don't forget this, you're only about 4 miles, and you're still getting these big shells over you, see, plopping all over the place.
And in rest, would you go back to Poppering?
No. From Ypres, I forget the name of the town behind there, some village. It's not Poppering, no.
Flamatinge?
I think Flamatinge. We went to Flamatinge, I think, yes. We went to Flamatinge, if I remember rightly. Well, let me tell you, when we were at Zillebeke, I haven't told you about this. When we were at Zillebeke, Sid Morris and I were in a dugout there, and we were going up the line. And there was always one man, delegate as a postman, you see. he used to go to the headquarters and get the bag of post for the battalion, and then it was his job to distribute the letters and parcels to whoever was. And that bag, you see, was sorted out from, say, platoons, or companies, and our company fellow was a fellow named Hill. And Sid and I were in this dugout, and we are getting what we call these 15-inch shells coming over regularly. Pretty great things. You could have like a train. They came out like a train. And then, funny enough, we're there, and Bill Hill was coming along with his bag of mail for us. And all of a sudden, one of these fellas came over and landed. There was no Hill. He'd gone. And all the letters and things was all over the place. The shell had blown him and everything else in the air to pieces. And eventually, I know he was picked up. He was picked up and sort of gathered together pieces of him. I know that. That was poor Bill Hill. It was a shocking business. Mm. But we saw all our letters in the air. Mm. It wasn't Sid Morris. It was another Sid somebody. I've forgotten.